and she said she clapped her hand upon her backside and bade the mayor kiss her there. You know, this is a woman who certainly didn't keep to half at home. She spoke her mind.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.
This is the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. And now, Ask the Expert with Steph.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Tudors Dynasty Podcast, Ask the Expert. I'm your host, Steph Storer, and today's episode is for those of you who love a good story. From circle time on the mat in kindergarten to bedtime with your parents to dinner table discussions or around a fire pit with a cocktail or two. People love to hear and share stories. Some, like our expert guest today, have made a living out of it. And I'm so pleased to welcome historian and professional storyteller Dave Tong to the show. Welcome, Dave.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's lovely to join you. I'm really looking forward to chatting tonight.
I can't wait to chat and I can't wait to hear a story. So we're so excited to get into Tudor folklore with you today because this is just such a fun topic. How did you get into this?
When it comes to actual storytelling, you kind of just drop into it. I mean, I was very lucky that, I'd always loved history at school. So when I finally became a mature student after being out in the real world for 10 years, it was natural that I would go back to history. And straight away, I was drawn to Tudor history. But I was actually working in a museum to fund my studies as a mature student. And I just happened to meet another storyteller who, you know, he'd been traveling around for years, mainly sort of working in the sort of environmental area, telling stories to children and adults as well. And we kind of fused my passion for history with his passion for storytelling. And that was 23 years ago now. And I haven't looked back since. Been working in heritage museums and that sort of area ever since.
23 years of storytelling sounds like such a great job. I can see why you'd want to keep going with it.
I'm just so lucky because, again, as I say, it really fuses my passion for history with, well, being creative as well. And to be honest, well, when you're talking about history to people, you know, and you talk about what I talk about mainly of the lower orders, you know, you see people's real interest in that they can know something about people in the past, but also that they can suddenly see that stories aren't just for young children, they're for us all. And you really bring joy to people, which kind of gives you something back at the same time. You know, when you're doing it well, you really get that kind of two-way street, that like it's not just for them, it's as much for you, you know, the storyteller.
I love that. Well, that's how you know you are in the right profession, right? If you love it so much, we can hear your passion. I think that's so great.
Exactly. You're quite right.
Yeah. So now when we're thinking of Tudor folklore, Tudor stories, or really any of the stories that you tell or that you research, where were these stories told first?
Really, it's a simple case of wherever people gathered, because as I've said already, we're talking about a time when stories weren't just for children. So whilst they were told by the hearth at home, in the household, everyone would have been listening, servants and everyone, but very much in that wider world, you know, wherever people gathered. So, you know, the marketplace, I mean, there's a lovely parallel, which we'll come back to when it comes to the court records, the history, looking at court records as I've done, you know, you see that people were very much gathering, not just in the marketplace to buy and sell. That was just one part of it. In Norwich, for example, where I come from, we have all the mayor's court records that tell us that all kinds of entertainments were also being put on there, punishments as well. So you might see someone in the stocks or the pillory, but you might see a play being performed. You might see a man who can perform wondrous feats with his mouth, or a woman who can perform wondrous feats with her feet. Yeah, it's kind of bizarre, stuff like that. A wondrous animal called a baboon. So at the same time, you're going to have storytellers there as well. But one of the obvious places they would have told stories as well, of course, was the tavern yard and the alehouse. And certainly when it came to the what were called the petty chapmen who were selling chat books, which were very thin, very cheaply produced collections of stories, that's where they would go to sell their wares, because there was a ready audience, not only to listen, but obviously their persons were loosened by the ale, so they might even buy one of the chat books, having heard one of the stories. So basically anywhere, Steph, really.
And now, where do you think, or I'm sorry, what do you think these stories would entail? And what I mean by that is, for something to live on and for people to share the information or to share the tale, is there something that they all have in common that makes people want to talk about them, or something that makes it interesting so that these stories can kind of originate somewhere and then become something that gets told over and over and again?
I think certainly there's an appeal to stories, certain stories, that means they carry on. I mean, that's why when it comes to stories, there's no new story. I mean, the stories tend to travel. The stories, I mean, we're talking about tales that were first printed in Tudor times here. That's why we call them Tudor tales. But of course, they originate much earlier than that in the oral culture. And like many of our stories, you know, they've come to us from other lands. I mean, throughout medieval times, you know, you've got Chaucer stories in Italy, you've got Boccaccio stories. They're coming from Middle Eastern influences, stuff like that. They're being brought over by soldiers and sailors, which of course becomes all the more prevalent during Tudor times with merchants as well. And I think the ones that have survived are the ones that really just have that appeal. And whilst there's many different types of stories in Tudor times, some of them are very, how can I put it, just scatological, gross. They have a certain curiosity value. They make people laugh. The ones I think that really stand out, certainly the ones that I've found, they tend to be the ones that are quite moral. And I don't mean they lecture people. They tend to mock vanity. They tend to mock greed. You know, this is why really a lot of the Robin Hood stories, the jests of Robin Hood, are coming to the fore in Tudor times, because they have that message. And also I think they appeal to a poorer audience as well, because, yeah, life is hard. You know, you might be ground down a lot of the time, but at least in story, the kind of the poorer man, the common sort, you know, the poor woman, they can rise to the surface and they can see those people who may don't, or sometimes they get punished, but more often than not, they get away with it because of their high position. At least in story, they get their comeuppance. So certainly that is a theme that is continuous. And interestingly enough, those are the stories that people really respond well to even today. You know, we still like to see people get punished for their greedy ways, their vanity, all of those things that, you know, stand out.
Right. People love seeing the good guy win. Yeah. And, you know, you want to see a happy ending, right?
Exactly. Or, you know, or maybe a tragic ending, as long as it's, as long as there's some rightings of wrong along the way.
Exactly. Exactly. And you also bring up a great point about, you mentioned a few minutes ago, them being printed or recorded. You know, the ones we're going to talk about today are in Tudor times, but who actually started recording them or printing them? Do you think that it was the teller of the stories or listeners who started actually recording these and printing them?
Well, I think the difficulty we have with all these this sort of thing is we are going back to a time where it's predominantly oral culture. So obviously it's like anything else at that time. Any records we have tend to come from the better off people, you know, what, the middling sort or above. When it comes to the stuff that's being printed at this time in the what's called the chat books, which is the very cheap print. Well, I think in that case, it's the people who are listening, because and when I say listening, they're the people who are these are backstreet printers who are desperate to print anything, really. If they can find something to print and sell, they will. So they're more concerned with the actual just getting the stories rather than caring about them that much. On the other hand, you've also got them what are called jest books, the stories, collections like we've got 100 Merry Tales, which is first printed in about 1526, The Mirror of Mirth at the end of the Tudor period from French sources, collections by people like Sir Nicholas Lestrange. Now, these jest books are, I suppose I'd call them of a higher order, in that they're not just simple collections of stories. They try and do more with them. They try and arrange them into themes. They actually try and arrange them as they would have done in Chaucer's time and that, and that they try and have a narrative in some way. And so these people who clearly, they care a bit more about the stories, and you do get a sense that those people are collectors of stories and they really do value them and they want to see them live on in some way. So yeah, that's why they're doing it. So that's not to say the poorer people didn't care about the stories, except they kept them within the oral culture. That's how they cared about them, just by telling them backwards and forwards.
So after having, you know, familiarized yourself with all these collections of stories, do you think that there's any kind of surviving themes that you can find that are retold in today's stories or in stories from other countries, or anything that sounds like it may have originated as the same story that became something else that we might know today?
Well, certainly as a storyteller, you see the same themes again and again. I mean, at the minute I'm working on a collection of Chichester tales, and there, for example, you see it all the time. You know, everyone, I mean, even in this country, people will claim a certain story to a certain locality, but you can't really do that. I mean, certainly Tudor times, a good example is the Pedlar of Swaffham. Swaffham is a small town in Norfolk. And certainly that story has been associated with Swaffham for hundreds of years. I mean, it's first actually recorded as being printed as the Pedlar of Swaffham in the 1600s. Now, of course, before that, it was part of the oral culture, so we can say it was probably a Tudor story in Swaffham. However, that story is originally, again, a Middle Eastern story, and you can get German versions of that story, Irish versions, you name it, people have got a version of that story. And that one has survived because it's a very simple story about a man who follows his dreams. He's very basic, very quickly. In his dream, he's told to go to London Bridge, for there he will hear good news. And when he gets there, the good news he hears is that actually the treasure he seeks is buried back in his own house, or rather in his own garden. And the reason that story, I think, has translated all over the world over a long time is because it's very simple, and it's a story that can appeal to young and old. So certainly those very simple stories travel. And others have traveled because we know they've traveled through time, because quite a few of the stories that are in those early jest books and chat books are actually, you see versions of them in, say, for example, the Brothers Grimm. And albeit they're very simplified versions, because what they've done is get rid of all the darker aspects that were quite common in Tudor times. And also there was a lot of bawdiness in the stories as well, you know, a little bit rude, too rude for even the Brothers Grimm. So they've come through. And even in Shakespeare, of course, because although he's famous for sort of borrowing from classical sources, he was influenced by the chapbooks and jest books. In fact, one of the collections of 100 Merry Tales is often referred to as Shakespeare's bawdy. So again, certain themes within, and as I said, certainly the theme of right and wrongs, and, you know, the poorer folk getting one over on the more greedy, richer people is one of those strong themes that comes through as well. So yeah, it's not just themes, but it's the quality of the tale in terms of who it appeals to as well.
It's so interesting, because when I asked that question, I was wondering if you were going to mention people like the Brothers Grimm, or, you know, Hans Christian Andersen or something like that. So that's very interesting that you did say the Brothers Grimm and even Shakespeare. I love that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I must admit, you know, when I'm thinking about this, there's a lot that doesn't come through. And that's one of the difficulties as a storyteller. There is quite a large amount of stories from this time, certainly in my book, but certainly in books of the time or collections of the time, that you can't really do a lot with. I mean, you do your best, and that's one of the things you have to remember, because it was predominantly an oral culture. At least when it's coming from the storyteller, they can if they're good at what they do, they can tailor it to their audience. So they can, you know, take away the darker aspects. They can, and of course, it depends whether they're telling to rich or poor, whether they're telling to Catholic or Protestant. They have that power to soften and make it a little bit more palatable. Yeah, we do have that problem, especially nowadays, with a lot of our stories in that, you know, they certainly don't fit in with a lot of our views, political views and what have you these days, you know, when it comes to gender and stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons when I put them in my book of stories that I fused them with the court records, because at least mixing them up with the court records that kind of link to them, at least it allows people, readers, to get an idea of the context from the time. So even if it's not a story they would particularly agree with today, at least they can see why it was told like that long ago.
That's very smart of you. That's definitely really helpful, because I think it is very hard for people nowadays to put things in the context in which it would have happened.
Yeah.
Because we definitely look, and, you know, through no fault of our own, but we definitely look at some stories or some even historical facts, things like that, with modern eyes, right? So yeah, that's really helpful of you. So let's talk about your book a little bit then. Right. Now, tell us, first of all, the name of your book.
It was originally called Tudor Tales. It's a hardback through the History Press here in the UK, and they've rebranded it as a paperback to Tudor Folk Tales, mainly because they've got a whole array of folk tales now from across the world, and they wanted it to fit with that whole kind of thing. But yeah, Tudor Folk Tales now in paperback.
So we can find it on Amazon, I'm guessing, right? You can order it pretty much anywhere you buy your books.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So now your book has two halves. Am I right? It's kind of split up into two halves.
Yes.
We have the historical half in the beginning, and then we go into the stories in the second half.
Each chapter is broken down. It's given a different title relating to the Great Commotion or things like that to do with the Reformation or whatever. But then each story is introduced with each story gets its own historical introduction, or each section of stories does, I should say, that relates in some way. So if it's a case of stories about, and when I say mocking women, it's mocking men as well. I don't mean it's just mocking women on their own, or, you know, stories about scolds or some such thing. The introduction is taken from the Mayor's Court in Norwich and also the Consistory Court, which were the church courts. And again, with stories, or rather, in that case, I should say, court records that relate to scolding or some such thing. But we'll come back to that, I dare say.
So as you were researching the historical part, can you tell us something that just you found interesting or something that helped you to better explain the stories in kind of a fun, interesting way?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky because I did an MA and I started a PhD, but I actually gave up on that to become a full-time storyteller. I ran away from that. But during my MA, I was actually very lucky that I was looking at a very interesting area, and it was looking in late Tudor Norwich. And the reason, not only because I come from Norwich, but Norwich is very lucky that it has a very complete collection of court records for this time. And I was looking at the way men and women actually related to each other in terms of how they were differences between punishments for men and women, but also how they slandered each other and stuff like that in the church courts, which was a very common thing. You know, again, it comes back to the fact that people were out in public a lot, and so it was a very powerful thing to slander someone. And when I was looking at that, what became apparent, not just in the cases of punishments for slander or whatever it would be, I became aware that, first of all, that the people we were dealing with, or I was dealing with, weren't that different to us. And also, you were seeing in the court records the reality of people as opposed to the idealized version of Tudor times. And I say that because if we look at, like, the laws of the time, the statutes and that, you get a sense of a very regulated society. You know, people in terms, you know, they had to dress in a certain way, they had to act in a certain way. Women were supposed to know their place and keep to hearth and home. But actually, when I started looking at the court records, certainly when it came to the poorer folk, they weren't acting like that at all, and they weren't that different to us, you know. And so again, as I say, it was that the reality of Tudor times which really appealed to me, that I could, you know, I can tell you exactly what so-and-so was saying to so-and-so, you know, at that time. Men were mocking their so-called betters. The mayor was often slandered by men. And not only that, women were taking the powerful to task as well. And it was a joy for me. I spent a couple of years going through these records, and I wasn't just looking at the ones about men and women in terms of their sexual behaviours I'd meant to and stuff like that. I was recording everything. So therefore, I had a lot of information to go in this book when I finally wrote it. I mean, I'll just give you an example of that. I hope I can say this. You know, Margaret Cayley was summoned towards the court, to Swanstead Court, and she said she clapped her hand upon her backside and bade the mayor kiss her there. You know, this is a woman who certainly didn't keep to half at home. She spoke her mind. You know, I can tell you that another man called John Venn, he was put in the stocks for making men believe he could find things that were lost. He was a trickster of the time. So naturally, when it came to writing my book, you know, when it came to trickster tales, I introduced that section with John Venn and others, counterfeit cranks, people who feigned illness. You know, a man called William Denny who counterfeited himself to be dumb in hope that he would then extort money from people, you know, people who were being kind to him. So yeah, you can know a lot, especially with the Mayor's Court in Norwich, because it dealt with all aspects of Norwich life, from regulation of prices to what people were wearing, to you know, all aspects of life, punishments, you name it.
Well, I think that all of those teasers are making not only me, but I'm sure our listeners at the moment need to hear a story. So what do you think about that, Dave? Do you think that you can give us one of your tales?
Well, do you know, Steph, I'd love to. And I was thinking about this. I've got a fairly short one. And since I mentioned John Venn, the trickster, who made people believe he could find things that were lost, I think a trickster tale. I mean, then as now, they were very popular. And one of the most popular tricksters, and this is I always struggle saying his name, it, like many of the stories that came over in Tudor times, not just far away, but also from Europe, from France and Germany, were the tales of Eulenspiegel or Eulenspiegel. Now, I say that because there are many variations of his name. In fact, once when I was telling stories in Sherwood Forest, I had a Dutchman and a German who both claim him as their own. He's their version of Robin Hood in a way, argue about the correct pronunciation. Now, I have a get-out clause because when the stories came over here to England, they were anglicised and his name became Howlglass. And again, very popular stories in Tudor times. So I'd like to tell you one of his stories, if that's okay.
It's not only okay, it is most welcome. Please do.
Wonderful. Well, I always start this story like this. There was once a trickster, a beguiler of the foolish, a coney-catching cunning man called Howlglass. He travelled from town to town, village to village, house to house, wearing many different disguises. Sometimes a priest, sometimes a potter, and sometimes a peddler of wares. But on this occasion, on this day, he arrived in a certain town disguised as a doctor of physic, a doctor. And he went abroad about the town, claiming that he could cure any ill. He said, know this to everyone who would listen. He said, know this, whether you have the sweating sickness, the pestilence, or the pox, whether you have boils on your belly, boils on your back, or even boils on your bare backside, I shall cure them all for a price, of course. And such were his boasts, they reached the ears of the director of the local hospital, who had many patients in his care who he could not cure. And so he went to see Dr. Howlglass and asked for his help. And Howlglass, he said, why, yes, of course, I can cure them all. Whether they have boils on their bellies, boils on their backs, or boils on their bums, I shall cure them for a price, of course. And he told the director that he would charge 100 gold coins for his service. But so confident was Dr. Howlglass, he said, know this. He said, know this. If I cannot cure but one of them, I will not take a coin. Well, the director, He had eyes for a bargain, and ears too, of course. And so he shook hands with Dr. Howleglass. And the following day, Howleglass, he arrived at the hospital. He was given a small chamber, a small room off the side of the great hall, where he might examine the patients one at a time. One by one by one, they were brought before Howleglass. One by one by one, they told him their tales of woe. For they told him of the boils on their back, of the boils on their bellies, and of the boils on their bare backsides. And as each told their tale of woe, Howleglass, he would scribble and scrape with pen upon parchment. He would tut, 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 and nod, nod, nod in all the right places. And when each in turn had finished their tale of woe, he would draw them close and say, "Listen, I like you. Do you like me?" "In fact, I like you so much," said Howleglass to each in turn, "I'm going to tell you a secret, although you must swear to tell no one else." When each in turn had sworn that they would not tell another living soul, he would say, "Know this, if I'm to cure you all, I must find the sickest one amongst you to burn and use the ashes to make a medicine that the rest of you will drink. If I'm to cure you all," says he, "I must find the sickest one amongst you to burn." Well, having each told each in turn the very same story, he went out into the hall. He ordered the servants of the hospital, they set and light a great fire. He ordered that all of the patients be brought before him. And now Howleglass, standing on a box so that all could see him, he called out, "Let he who is the sickest one here step forward." But none stepped forward. He went from one to the next, asking each in turn, "Are you the sickest one here?" But each in turn they said no, they were not sick at all. In fact, they'd been cured, that it was a miracle cure. And even though most of them hadn't walked more than a few steps in many years, all now ran quickly from the hospital. And so it was, the patients were cured for a day or two at least. The director of the hospital, he was happy for a day or two at least. But Dr. Howleglass, he was very rich and very happy for a very long time to come. And there ends my Tudor tale. I hope you enjoyed it, Steph.
Dave, I think that you are mesmerizing and you are absolutely in the right profession. And I wish that was longer. So I would love to hear some more stories. Where can our listeners hear you tell more stories? Well, and of course, we want them to buy the book as well. But where do you go? Where can we find you?
Do you know what? It's lovely having in the book. And I will say this, what's nice about when you take stories, adapt them from chat books and jest books at this time, they tend to be anecdotal. So you tend to put yourself in the story, just as I did there. And certainly in my book, I've tried to write them as I tell them, because many of the stories I've been telling for years now. But it is nice to hear them told live, especially if you're face to face. But that said, I do have a YouTube channel. It was done at the start of the lockdown period, so it was quite rough and ready. But at least you see me as well as hear me. So it is nice. Yeah, YouTube channel, you can find me on under the Yarn Smith on YouTube. And I'm also on something called the World Storytelling Cafe. Again, if you Google that, you should be able to find that. And that's a lovely resource for hearing lots of different stories, world tales, as well as my stories. You can find me on there as well.
The World Storytelling Cafe, that sounds awesome. So we will have to check that out, and we will definitely have to check out your YouTube channel as well. We will all buy your book, and I'm so happy and honored that you came on today and that you shared your story and your voice with us today, because like I said, it was mesmerizing, and I wish you could have kept going. But again, thank you so much for joining us today, Dave.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Steph.
And of course, I have to thank our listeners as well. We couldn't do it without you. So thank you to all of you who have written in with questions. Thank you to all who are listening to this week's episode. As always, we appreciate your support, and we hope you'll tune in again next time as we continue to ask our experts the pressing questions you want answered. And if you love the Tudors Dynasty podcast and want to show even more support, please consider becoming a patron where you'll not only receive the great content we're offering now, but extra insider research, information, prizes, and other exciting opportunities that are only offered by subscribing. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. You can follow and support the Tudors Dynasty Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon at Tudors Dynasty.